Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bentley, Judge Larkin, Judge Siegel, the Honorable Elizabeth G. Bentley presiding.
Good morning. May be seated. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. For the audio record, today is June 25th, 2025. Today's argument is being live streamed, and we are also making an audio recording, which will be available on our court's website within 24 hours. A reminder that there are no other recordings permitted without express permission of the Court of Appeals. We have four cases on our calendar this morning, three with oral argument and one for a non-oral conference. With that, I will ask the marshal to please call the first case.
Now calling case number A25-0040 in the matter of the eligibility of RMC for crime victim reimbursement, reimbursement claim number 048733.
Good morning, counsel. A couple of housekeeping matters. You'll each be given 15 minutes for your argument this morning, and then appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And please feel free to adjust the height of the podium using the buttons on the front if you so choose. And before you begin your argument, I ask that you identify yourself and your client for the record. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Francis Herbert White III, and I have the honor here to represent the relator in this matter, whose name I shall not mention. May it please the court. The matter before the court involves a claim that was made by my client on behalf of the estate of her mother for reimbursement for injuries that she suffered as the result of a crime. When determining this, when making its decision, the Crime Victim Reimbursement Board erred in two significant ways. To begin with, they erred by finding that she was tardy in filing her request for reimbursement, which was known as reparations at the time. Then, the board erred when it determined that it should not have she should not receive compensation for the expenses that were incurred at English Rose Suites. The second error is much more egregious than the first error, because the second error should never have been reached. A statute of limitations restriction is jurisdictional. If the board determined that there was no jurisdiction because she had not timely filed, it should never have reached a decision on the second part. This is almost unheard of in American jurisprudence. There is, however, one case that stands to mind where a court has said the individual lacks the jurisdiction to appear before this tribunal and yet renders a decision which, in my opinion, was the most abhorrent decision ever rendered in the United States. In 1857, in Scott v. Sanford, 60 U.S. 893, the Supreme Court of the United States said that Dred Scott had no jurisdiction to come before the court. That should have ended the matter. At that point in time, the court should have done nothing else. The board should have done nothing else after determining.
But can you help us understand the significance for your client of that, of having reached that decision? I mean, what's the prejudice of having reached that decision on the merits to your client?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And that is actually spelled out in the respondent's brief, what the prejudice was. The prejudice is, if you look on page 4 of their brief, in footnote number 2, it says at the bottom, the ALJ declined to reach these issues. She concluded it even accepted relator's theory of the 2017 sexual assault. Reimbursement was barred by the statute of limitations and the lack of evidence of direct causation. By making a jurisdictional decision and then not making a decision on the whole record, What the ALJ and the board, by adopting the ALJ's findings, did was went beyond what her writ was. And her writ was to simply determine first, and she determined it in a negative sense. There should be just one issue before this board, whether or not my client was timely when she filed her claim. And I argue before this court, speaking to that, that she was, in fact, timely. And she was timely because in order for someone to...
I just want to understand. I mean, oftentimes courts reach multiple dispositive issues, for example, up on appeal. I mean, if we were to agree with you on the statute of limitations issue, then the merits issue becomes ripe, right, as to whether or not these were the losses were a direct result of the crime. Here you're arguing that that was wrong on statute of limitations, then why wouldn't it be appropriate for us to consider the merits question, assuming we agree with you?
Assuming that you agree with me, Your Honor, it would not be ripe for the very reason that is recorded in footnote number 2 on page 4 of the respondent's brief. The ALJ did not consider the elements. The ALJ did not consider the element, the other interesting things that are in there on whether or not a crime took place.
Well, but I think what the way I understood the decision was, it was assumed that the ALJ assumed a crime took place and still found that the reimbursement request was without merit because it wasn't a direct result of the crime. We do that sometimes where you assume one part in order to reach so you don't have to decide what you don't have to decide.
Right. Yes, I do understand that. But what I'm asking this court to do is then to remand it to say that the ALJ and the board were wrong on their decision for timeliness, and then remand it back to them to include everything, to make a decision, to render a decision on all aspects of it, including the causation, because the state. Excuse me, the board is relying on causation as a rationale for their theory that the eggshell plaintiff should not apply. The eggshell plaintiff doctrine should not apply in this case. That is a case of first impression, that whether or not the eggshell doctrine would apply. And it's a case of first impression because he's right. It comes up in torts and tortfeasors in tortious cases.
But setting that aside, yes, I mean, you're talking about the eggshell plaintiff. That doesn't eliminate the requirement for causation. And as I read the ALJ and the board's decision here, they're saying there's not causation because she needed some type of nursing home care. Now, what type or where to get that? Is another question. So was there any evidence? And I will note that no transcripts were ordered.
No,
so we're
right.
Limited in our review of the record here. But given that fact, was there any evidence in the record that we've got that English Rose was the only place that could accommodate this all-female staffing?
The evidence, Your Honor, I believe, and I don't know the exhibits off the top of my head, are the letters from English Rose Suites saying that.
Okay, but they don't say that. Is there anything else?
Not off the top of my head, Your Honor.
Okay.
But
all right.
The reality of it is, Your Honor, is when the state, in this case through the board, steps into the place of the tortfeasor as far as compensation is concerned.
But where's the causation? That's the thing. The eggshell plaintiff. That the causation has to be there, and then whatever shape your plaintiff's in are the damages. That goes to the scope of the damages, right?
It goes to the scope of the damages. You're absolutely right, Your Honor.
So what's the causation here? Because she had Alzheimer's, and she needed nursing home care, is my understanding from the record, and I don't see any evidence to the contrary. It's just where and what, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. The causation is the fact of the... determination of the crime, whether or not a crime took place, which the ALJ did not do and did not reach the conclusions on that. So that's an element of the causation.
But not whether or not it didn't cause her to require nursing home care. From my reading of the record, the crime is that, and this is a terrible situation. So in questioning this and digging into it, it's not out of a lack of respect or concern for the situation. But that she preferred, I don't know if there's, let's assume that she needed for really appropriate care, that personal cares be by all female caregivers. But not, the crime didn't cause her to be in a nursing home or to require nursing home care. Do you understand that? Can you help me out here?
Yeah, I can understand the conundrum that you're facing. The individual would have required nursing home care of some kind, whether or not the crime took place. I think that's what Your Honor is trying to say.
Yeah, that's my understanding from
right.
the record.
The position of the relator throughout this entire proceeding is that the nursing home care that was required because of the crime that took place. If I may,
evidence? So the fact that she needed nursing home level care, you're saying is a direct result of the crime?
That she needed that nursing home level care.
Okay, so then where's the evidence that was the only nursing home, and that wouldn't it just be any differential in cost, assuming that English Rose was more expensive than other nursing homes? And not the whole cost of the nursing home?
The ALJ and the board never came to that conclusion.
Well, did you argue that?
I don't.
It seems like you were saying 100%.
We were saying 100%. That is correct, Your
Honor.
Okay.
All right. And then will you address the tardiness issue? So
yes, Your Honor.
Our standard of review here is whether there's substantial evidence in the record. And so the board's decision was based on the fact that as soon as her mom came back to relatives' home for care after being in Catholic elder care, that she immediately noticed a personality change, and she didn't want to be cared for by male caregivers. And so she noticed that right away. And then in December 7th, I guess, of 2017, there was the diagnosis of the sexually transmitted disease. And at that point, it looks like there was enough evidence to know that, or reason to know that a crime may have occurred. So why is that? Why? And that's all in the record. So why does that not meet the substantial evidence? What's your argument on the tardiness?
My argument on that is that it's also in the record that she had multiple nursing home care. She went to multiple nursing home care facilities. Prior to English Rose Suites, none of the nursing home facilities were all female staffed. They were all, they had a mix, male and female. The assumption that a daughter who loves her mother would put a mother back into a nursing care, a nursing home, a facility, where she reasonably believed her mother had been sexually assaulted is absurd. The conclusion that is reached that on December 7th, when you learned that your mother had a sexually transmitted disease, and she was displaying other symptomology of that, that assumption is beyond the pale, and it's beyond the pale because it took her time to realize that her mother had actually been sexually assaulted
after
the diagnosis.
So what's the point in the record where we can draw that conclusion. And again, we have no transcripts. So again, we don't know the testimony. All we have are the exhibits.
That was done for two reasons, Your Honor. One, it's a strategic decision. And the other reason that it was done is because one of the board's witnesses made aspersions towards female naval veterans that I, as a disabled veteran of the United States Air Force, find appalling. And I don't want that further in the record than it already is.
When we're looking at the standard, you know, the issue is when the injury was reasonably discoverable. It sounds like the way that you were just framing your argument was about when this individual, when the relator's daughter, actually knew. But isn't this an objective test about when it was reasonably discoverable, not when she actually did, even to the extent that maybe she didn't realize it? But is that the standard?
Objectively speaking, Your Honor, nobody would put their parent into a nursing home where they had suffered a sexual assault, and the relator put her mother back in the same facility in January of 2018. So the reality is that she could not have known that diagnosis was related to that to her stay in a nursing home. No objective person would connect the two and then put their mother back in the same facility. I didn't order the transcript for those reasons, because I think the record is clear already on its face. I see my time is up.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Nathan Hartshorn. I'm an Assistant Attorney General at the Minnesota Attorney General's Office, and I'm here representing the respondent in this matter, the Crime Victims Reimbursement Board. From the exchanges with counsel, it certainly appears to me that Your Honors understand the fundamental issues that the board has put in our brief. So for the most part, I think I just want to stand on my brief. I mean, I'm very happy to answer any questions Your Honors have. But with regard to our argument regarding statute of limitations, our argument regarding causation, I think the brief makes those arguments, and from the colloquies that I've heard, it certainly appears to me that the court understands those arguments. I do need to address, however, some of the things that Mr. White has brought up, because they definitely certainly fill my mind in on where relator's coming from on some of these arguments. The point that that counsel began with, which is some offense that he takes at the board reaching both the statute of limitations and the causation issue, I'm not sure that fits with the role of an administrative agency making determinations about its authority to grant a particular statutory benefit. The statute of limitations issue and the causation issue are both applications of the board's statute. They go to the question of whether Minnesota statutes authorize the board to award reimbursement under particular factual circumstances. And those are two independent grounds. One of them is that the claim was not filed within 3 years of the point at which the injury was reasonably discoverable. The other one is whether this constitutes an economic loss as defined by the statute, because on the basis of the question of whether it was directly caused by the crime, or the economic loss was directly caused by the injury. Those two questions both go to the board's legal authority to award the reimbursement that relator is looking for. They don't go to the board's quasi-judicial ability to address the question. The board, this is a quasi-judicial decision, which is why we're here on certiorari, but the board's not a court, and its ability to address questions is quite different than a court's a court's jurisdictional authority to address questions at all. The question of whether the claim that relator is making is something the board can award reimbursement for is affected statutorily by both the statute of limitation question and the causation question. Both of those are independent grounds for the board not to award, or the board to conclude that it doesn't have the statutory authority to award a reimbursement. So for the board in its quasi-judicial decision-making to find on two different grounds, hey, we can't award these because of this statutory problem, and we can't award them because of this statutory problem, it's not a jurisdictional matter the way that it would be for a court to rule on, hey, do we even have the jurisdiction to hear this case at all? And then, something about the merits. The board's decision is quasi-judicial, but it's not literally judicial. These are two statutory infirmities with the claim that relator is putting here. And so the idea that it's inappropriate for an agency to reach both a statute of limitations issue and then what you could call a merits issue, I don't think there's any legal basis for to complain about that. And indeed, relator didn't do that in their brief. This is new this morning.
Could I ask just a quick question?
Uh-huh.
So is there evidence in the record that the test results, the STD test results, were communicated on December 7th?
I'm not sure, and for the same reason that Your Honor has referenced a couple of times, I have not been able to review a transcript because there isn't a transcript. The ALJ, however, did find in her decision, she did find that, as a matter of fact, that relator was aware of the diagnosis as of December 7th. That's in the ALJ's report. That's the conclusion she reached after hearing the evidence that we don't have a transcript to review. And so that was the ALJ's factual finding, and a factual finding that the board adopted. More specifically than that, I'm not aware of a specific thing on the record that explicitly supports that point. It's a finding of fact that the ALJ made.
So we have a diagnosis on December 7th,
mm-hmm.
which could, I guess it begs the question of where did this infection come from?
Yes.
But alone doesn't necessarily indicate that it was the result of a sexual abuse.
Certainly not.
And certainly not at this one facility, right? And even
right.
the question.
Or at that one time.
Another question about when or what period of time, right?
Right.
So if that's true, then it seems like behavior changes are relevant to this idea of reasonable discovery, right? That it's not just a diagnosis, but also behavior changes that would then put someone on notice that, oh, this is actually the result of a sexual abuse.
Right.
So can you address the timing of the behavioral, in the record that we have, the timing of the behavioral changes and whether or not that those changes had occurred by the time of the diagnosis, such that that's the date?
Indeed. The ALJ's findings of fact are that, and this I am more confident was based on particular testimony from relator herself on the stand, that she noticed this change in her mother's behavior. I don't think this is contested between the parties either. That she noticed the change in her mother's behavior immediately after her mother left that first 3-week stint at Catholic Home Care in August, September of 2017. Among the findings of fact in the ALJ's report, if I remember correctly, is that was something that relator took note of immediately in September of 2017, and which then makes the herpes diagnosis on December 7th of 2017 the final piece of the puzzle, or what she now contends was the puzzle that demonstrates that there was a sexual assault.
And what's your response then if those facts together could reasonably make the sexual abuse discoverable, why would she have put her mother back in the same facility?
And we don't have an answer for that. We can't explain why, even though she was aware of facts that she would, within a couple of months, conclude, demonstrated that there was sexual assault, why she put her mother back in there. We don't know that, but we don't need to know that for the reason that Your Honor referenced in your colloquy with counsel. This is an objective standard. The board's standard is whether something is reasonably discoverable, not reasonably discovered. And counsel, and again, at oral argument, this is the first time I finally understood what counsel is talking about, and because he put it in his brief that this couldn't have been discovered until January 2018, and you know that because Relator put her mother back into Catholic home care. That doesn't demonstrate that it couldn't have been discovered on December 7th. It just demonstrates that it wasn't discovered by her as of January of 2018. She had not put together what she now says are the pieces of the puzzle. Doesn't mean it wasn't discoverable. Her factual theory now, given that it's based on only those two facts, the change of behavior and the herpes diagnosis, her factual theory is that it was discoverable based on those two facts. She just didn't happen to do it until after the January stint. Given what, just the word, the plain meaning of the word discoverable and how that is an objective standard, and it does not hang on whether Relator herself actually did discover it, but just on whether she could reasonably have discovered it. The fact that she could reasonably have discovered it but didn't doesn't change the fact that she could reasonably have discovered it. And so under an objective standard, which counsel is simply not applying, he is insisting on applying a subjective standard. My client didn't figure it out. That doesn't matter. The question is whether it was reasonably discoverable. And that's what the statute of limitations argument hangs on. Now,
the causation question.
Yep.
To Judge Siegel's point, might there have been, to counsel, might there have been a claim for loss for a difference in cost between the two and? Is that different? Is the point here that that's just not what they were asking for?
Largely, yes. That's not an explanation, not a claim, not an evidentiary presentation that they've ever made at any point in this case. They have been seeking 100% of the fees for English Rose Suites from the beginning, with no evidence offered, no explanation provided, no attempt to identify any kind of differential. I mean, there is the notion present in the case, I think some people have surmised it, I guess, that English Rose Suites is more expensive than other assisted living facilities. That might be true, but I have no idea, because there's definitely nothing in the record about that at all. And the only information there is about dollars or costs here is a very simple, straightforward, here's how much money Relator spent on English Rose Suites. That's it. And I mean, she wants that reimbursed. And is that more than she would have spent to these other facilities? Record doesn't say so. I mean, it could be true, but there's no basis in the record to conclude that. They haven't made any kind of argument that what we're actually looking for is the margin by which this was more expensive, that which they would then surmise that we're paying that extra amount for the female only care attendants. Now, I think it's worth noting that her personal care physician who took care of her at English Rose Suites, I mean, a very important exhibit in this case is the letter that he wrote responding to Relator's attempt to get him to say, oh, yes, the money you spent at English Rose Suites was because of this sexual assault. He explicitly said, no, I cannot say that. Here are all the things that she got from English Rose Suites, and here are the conditions that those services were addressing. And sexual assault, was not, to his knowledge, part of any of that. And I mean, it would be arguable, even if we were talking about some kind of marginal value, it would be arguable whether that marginal value is actually attributable to single-sex care or something else that English Rose offers. That's very much an open question. But
can you help me understand this idea of direct result? And uh-huh. Does it have to be the sole cause of the loss, or can there be multiple causes?
To some extent, this is a question of first impression from the Minnesota courts. That has not been presented to the courts. And the ALJ's suggestion, which both parties have accepted, is that the Supreme Court's standard in State versus Boettcher for criminal restitution is the one that ought to apply here, and the direct causation that that involves. And under State versus Boettcher, restitution is available, quote, only for losses that are directly caused by or follow naturally as a consequence of the defendant's crime. And I mean, under that standard, if you have the case here where there are three intervening years between this alleged sexual assault and the expenses at English Rose Suites, and during that 37 months, the relator's mother undergoes two disastrous falls. Just 2 months before she goes into English Rose Suites, she falls and fractures her hip at a previous facility. That has horrendous deleterious effects on her health, and the physician in that letter referenced that fall, that hip fracture, and the consequences that had. Given all of these things that happened to her, it's impossible for me to see how one could possibly draw a line of causation, which the relator needs to do, from September 2017, when the sexual assault allegedly happened, through all of these three harrowing years and these horrible things that happened to her, to October of 2020, when then she moves into English Rose Suites. Drawing a line of causation through that and saying that, oh, yeah, it was all caused by that assault and not the horrible things, not necessarily criminal things, but horrible things that happened to her in between, I don't understand how you could possibly draw a line of causation with all of those intervening factors. So that's the central problem with the causation theory that they've got here. And I guess just the other part is that then they want the entire, and their argument has only ever been that the entire cost for English Rose Suites needs to be reimbursed by the board, even though the best that could be said for their claim, but they've never argued this, is that what could be reimbursed is just the extra margin that they paid for having only same-sex caregivers. It's worth noting that the connection between this alleged sexual assault and same-sex caregivers is entirely relator's surmise. That there is no evidence specifically about that, that the reason she needed that was because of a sexual assault. That's her daughter's inference, but there's no expert testimony. There's nothing else to make that connection. If the court doesn't have any further questions, I would just ask that the court affirm the board's decision. Thank you very much.
Counsel?
Your Honors. The board has argued in their oral argument that the diagnosis of a sexually transmitted disease was the final piece in the puzzle. And he has repeatedly reminded the court, that the board had to apply, and this court needs to apply, an objective standard. I agree. You need to apply an objective standard. And objectively, even if she knew on December 7th of 2017, she had been informed the same day that her mother had tested positive for a sexually transmitted diseases, it is not reasonable to presume that you would immediately associate that with a sexual assault. And then the following month, put her back into the same care facility. It took the relator several years to reach the conclusion that her mother actually had been the victim of the crime, and it was only reasonable that that would happen because we have a tendency to trust the caregivers in these facilities. When it comes right down to it, Your Honors, nobody would objectively put a parent in a facility where they're going to be harmed, unless, of course, they're a sociopath.
My understanding of the record we have is that there were behavior changes starting at least in September of 2017 of not wanting to interact with male caregivers. And then you know, by December 7th, we get the diagnosis. What facts are there in the record that occurred after that date that would be, that add to the puzzle then? Or is it still just the behavior changes and the diagnosis? It just took time to realize that.
Yes. The behavior changes and the diagnoses are pieces of the puzzle, but they're not the final pieces of the puzzle. It is the failure at the other nursing homes that was the final piece of the puzzle. They put in there that says when she has female caregivers, there's a problem here. Or when she doesn't have female caregivers.
Where is that in the record? So you're saying there was a communication from one of the nursing homes saying that?
No, Your Honor. It is the fact that she went from each nursing home to each nursing home, coupled with the letter from English Rose Suites that say that they will in fact provide only female-only nursing homes.
All right.
There needs to be an inference drawn. I recognize that, and the board had that information in front of them in order to draw that inference.
So, quick question. Counsel for the board referenced the Boettcher decision, which you also did in your brief as being the correct standard. So is that the correct standard we should look at in assessing what was the direct result of the crime?
I agree that this is a case of first impression for something that is a non-criminal matter. So I agree with counsel for that, and I expect that this decision is likely to be published for that reason. However, when he quoted the Boettcher decision, he left something out of it.
Okay.
He says that it's only for losses that are directly caused by the defendant's crime, but or follow naturally as a consequence of the defendant's crime.
I think, just to make clear, I think Mr. Hartshorn did include that part of the
quote.
Okay, yeah.
I may have missed it, and I
don't.
Yeah,
no, but I understand your point.
My point is that or follow naturally as a consequence of the crime. If someone bleeds to death because they were hit by a car, that's a direct result of the crime. But if they suffer an injury that doesn't kill them for several years later, that doesn't directly result. It is a natural consequence. And in this case, the need for female-only caregivers that could only be provided by English Rose Suites followed naturally as a consequence of the crime. I see my time is up. I ask you to remand this to the board to do their job and to do it right. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. This case has been submitted, and we'll issue an opinion in the time prescribed by statute.